The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that will help clarify the limits of free speech online. Pennsylvania resident Anthony Alonis challenged his conviction for making threats against his estranged wife on Facebook, claiming that the violent language he posted was a form of therapeutic self-expression and was not intended to threaten her. In deciding the case, the court will have to balance traditional First Amendment values with the modern realities of technology, a problem that has arisen more and more in recent years. For example, the court has had to apply the Fourth Amendment's search and seizure provisions to smartphones and privacy rights to law enforcement GPS tracking. And the current national debate about police body cameras is also sure to invoke questions of constitutional privacy. Today in The Exchange, 225 years after the ratification of the Constitution, how are we reconciling our founding document with the technology of our modern world? What do you think? Is technology changing the way we interpret our Constitution? And should it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Professor Jennifer Sargent is with us. She's a visiting associate professor at Dartmouth. She served as a district court judge in New Hampshire for 8 years and also as a public defender. And Professor Sargent, thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Professor John Graby, constitutional scholar, professor at UNH School of Law. And Professor Graby, good to see you and welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and Professor Graby, I want to start with you. What were the conditions under which the founders were drafting our Constitution and our Bill of Rights? What were they thinking about as they crafted this document? Obviously, they weren't thinking about the internet.
No, to say the least. They were working in a context where there was the experience following the revolution was that many believed after the revolution that the national government was insufficiently strong, and they were trying to craft a new balance of power. The problem was that all power was located in the states. The states were very responsive to local populations. The states were often enacting measures that were protectionist, that were causing conflict with other states.
This is the Articles of Confederation.
Yes, under the Articles of Confederation. They just weren't working. And so they decided to try this experiment, which they split the atom of sovereignty, to quote Justice O'Connor. And they said we're going to try to create this national government while maintaining what we call our federal structure, power in the state governments. Interestingly, the initial constitution that emerged from Philadelphia didn't even contain a Bill of Rights. And I think most of the founders would have been very surprised to learn that our system depends so much on the third branch, on the judiciary, to enforce individual rights. Some states only ratified the Constitution on the condition that it include a Bill of Rights, and James Madison wrote the Bill of Rights, but he, in fact, didn't favor the inclusion of a Bill of Rights.
Really?
He was opposed to it. He was in the House of Representatives, but he was concerned about delegating that responsibility to others, so he took responsibility for drafting it because he recognized that he had to, but he was worried about that listing individual rights would imply that the people did not have other rights. And beyond that, he didn't really think that a Bill of Rights meant all that much. He thought that the way that rights would be protected would be by achieving a proper balance of power between the federal government and the states, and then among the three branches of the new government that was created by the Constitution.
So what were they trying to protect against? What kind of things? I mean, specifically for our conversation today, the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment come up a lot, John.
Yeah, it's really interesting. the First Amendment was actually directed just at Congress, and insofar as it protects free speech, it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Shortly thereafter, two federal laws were passed that were clearly in violation of the spirit of the First Amendment, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were used to imprison opponents of the government. People are often surprised to learn we still have not yet reached the 100th anniversary of the Supreme Court first enforcing the First Amendment as a limitation on government. That didn't happen till the end of World War I. The Fourth Amendment, same thing. It was the Fourth Amendment was drafted and enacted in the context of opposition to these writs of assistance that the British used to conduct general searches during the colonial times. And so the thought was that the government needed to get a warrant and to have some sort of individualized suspicion before it could intrude into private places. But much like the First Amendment, Fourth Amendment law really didn't begin to develop until the 20th century. And it's really been only in the last century that we've had this system where we have a judiciary enforcing individual constitutional rights in a way where they're saying no to popular legislation or actions by the executive branch.
You know, and it may seem silly, Professor Sargent, but I can't help but wonder, plunk James Madison, down with us today, and we're using that Fourth Amendment search and seizure, for example, provision to talk about smartphones.
Right.
I mean, what would James Madison even think?
Well, first of all, James Madison wouldn't know what we were even looking at.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that James Madison would even know what a cell phone was. And even if we explained to him what it was, it would kind of sound like, men
science
from
fiction.
Mars. Yeah. So, but the Supreme Court has talked about smartphones in a way that they've called the mini computers. In fact, in California versus Riley, which is the newer Supreme Court case from the spring of 2014, the Supreme Court called them mini computers and said that people are keeping their entire lives on these cell phones, that it's not just a matter of people keeping certain amounts of information, but they're keeping so much information on them now that what it does is it forms a narrative of someone's life, that their entire life can be told as a story by picking out pieces from the cell phone. And because of that, and also because cell phones are so pervasive, meaning so many people have them, the Supreme Court said that it had to look at it much more as just a piece of equipment and actually as something that houses people's lives, the stories of people's lives. So a cell phone isn't just a mini computer. It's actually a narrative.
I didn't realize that they called it that, a mini computer.
They did. Mm-hmm. They equated it to a mini computer.
A lot more questions for both of you. But let me also invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the issue of reconciling our Constitution with some of the questions that come up surrounding modern technology, especially smartphones, social media. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. How do we apply some of these cherished principles from more than 200 years ago to some of the technologies and communications that we have today? Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Sargent, Professor Grabe, let's go to our listeners. And Yolanda's calling from Nashua. Hi, Yolanda. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I called as soon as I heard that there's a man out there that is hiding behind the First Amendment right of freedom of speech through something he posted on Facebook making threats. I feel that anyone who's grown knows that threatening someone, there should be consequences. With Facebook, you have a network of people that you're putting this information out to. This isn't anything that's private, and people are aware of that when they sign up for something like Facebook. So I think that poor woman, he's not saying, I don't like her hair color. He's making her feel unsafe. So I absolutely feel that that should be taken to the next level, and there should be consequences for that, as if he threatened her in her own home.
Well, Yolanda, thank you for calling. And let's talk about this case then, folks. This was just heard, oral arguments before the High Court this week. Professor Sargent, you've looked closely at this Alonis case, as it's known. What approach have you noticed the court taking in these decisions?
Well, what the Supreme Court was reviewing in this case and is reviewing in this case as the seminal question is, whether or not the supposed threat, the words that Mr. Alonis used, should be judged as a threat from an objective standpoint or a subjective standpoint, meaning is it important that Mr. Alonis himself intended or did not intend the words to be a threat to a particular person or to particular people, here his ex-wife and an FBI agent, or whether we should judge or whether the courts should judge the threat on what we call a reasonable person standard, whether it's an objective standard. So whether a reasonable person would believe that the language that Mr. Alonis used was threatening, and whether the court decides it should be judged from an objective standard or a subjective standard really is quite important, because what we're doing is we're talking about the intent of Mr. Alonis versus
how she feels.
How she feels about it. Although I don't think the Supreme Court, I don't think anyone would argue that the language wasn't somewhat threatening. It's important to think about whether the language was directed towards someone. A threat that's not directed towards someone is not what's called a true threat, which is in the case law that the Supreme Court has enumerated, really what makes a threat a threat. Free speech and the First Amendment allow people to say things that can be threatening in a vacuum. The question is it directed towards someone? Mr. Alonis, in this case, contends that his threats or the language that he used, A, he contends that it wasn't threatening, but B, he contends that it wasn't directed at any particular person, that it was an expression.
That he was venting.
That he was venting. It was perhaps an artistic, albeit inarticulately artistic, way of expressing him, perhaps in a rap song kind of way. So whether or not he meant it as a threat is really at the heart of the question the Supreme Court has to answer.
Is threatening speech, Professor Grabe, covered by the First Amendment?
No. The Supreme Court has said that true threats are a category of verbal communication that's outside of First Amendment protection. You know, in the First Amendment more generally, it's a vexing problem, you know, to come back to the theme that you started with. You know, how do we project forward this guarantee of free speech that was written at a very different time? How does that cover the fact that speech is often more than speech? Speech is also conduct, and speech can harm, speech can injure.
Well, sure. If she's too afraid to go outside her house, then she's harmed.
Yeah. I mean, same thing with, you know, this is a question that's raised in all sorts of contexts, you know, the workplace context. If somebody is sexually harassing somebody but is doing it verbally, should that the First Amendment protect that, or is that something that society can regulate? We struggle with this in all sorts of contexts, and there are no easy answers.
All right. Well, we'll talk a lot more about that then after a short break. Yolanda, thank you for joining us. You can call to 1-800-892-6477. More in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the high court meets high tech. We're talking about how to apply the Constitution to smartphones, Facebook, and other forms of modern communication. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Sargent, a little bit more on the free speech issues that came up in this Alonis case. Again, this is the woman who felt threatened by her estranged husband, threats that he made against her on Facebook. I'd love your thoughts, too, on what Professor Grabe said about whether threatening speech is protected or not by the First Amendment.
Well, threatening speech, as Professor Grabe said, is not protected by the First Amendment if it is a true threat. Now, in the original case, the case that is really at the center of the Alonis case, which is Virginia versus Black, is a free speech case where there was conduct involving a cross burning and whether or not that burning cross was threatening in a particular situation in which it was burnt.
I remember that case, actually. Yeah, go
and
ahead.
Clarence Thomas actually wrote the opinion in that case. And taking the principle that's in Virginia versus Black and applying it to Alonis is a little bit different, because what happened in Alonis is on Facebook. It's on social media. It's in a medium that's very pervasive and very common. So it's the kind of medium where someone can just very impulsively write a thought and send it out to the world. It's a very uncontrolled situation, whereas situations such as those in Virginia versus Black, where people actually have to get together, take certain actions,
physically do something.
Right. There's more of a contemplative aspect to it than there is in a Facebook type situation. I mean, I'm sure we all have had the experience perhaps of even writing an email and hitting the send button and thinking, oh, maybe
five minutes later.
A little quick. Yeah. And posting something on Facebook perhaps and then having the opportunity to go back and delete it. And Facebook offers a lot of opportunities to direct certain speech at certain things and certain people. For instance, there's tagging, which means you can actually write someone's name who is on Facebook and it will tag them and indicate to them that the speech is directed towards them. There are certain privacy settings that one can set on Facebook that allow certain people to see the information and certain people not to see the information. So the fact that Facebook is just a really easy vehicle for the information to be transmitted obviously lends itself to overuse and abuse in some situations. But it's also a way for people to express themselves the way they haven't perhaps been able to express themselves before Facebook and social media existed. So there's that tension that social media and Facebook bring to the conversation. And that is, when does something that is said on Facebook actually become a threat? And the question we really have to go back to, well, is it just merely threatening or is it directed at a particular person?
I see. So the difference between threatening and a threat.
Correct.
Two different things. And, you know, what's interesting, I'm glad you raised the Facebook aspect of that because I did want to ask you about that. Professor Grabe, you too. I mean, I'm sure that courts have dealt with the issue of free speech and whether threatening is a threat or threatening. How does the Facebook angle, though, that Professor Sargent describes make this case a little bit different?
Well, as we go through significant societal changes, we struggle to make old legal principles adapt to new circumstances. I'll just return, for example, to the Fourth Amendment for a second. For the first, for the first many decades of jurisprudence under the Fourth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment was really interpreted as being coextensive with property. You know, the Fourth Amendment basically protected you when you were in your house or on your property. And property law played a really prominent role in determining Fourth Amendment boundaries. That all changed about 40 or 50 years ago when we recognized that more people were living in proximity to one another, more people were living in cities. The world had changed. And as the world changed, the jurisprudence changed. And we moved away from a property-based set of principles informing Fourth Amendment doctrine to a set of doctrines that took account of the fact that society changed. And we looked to what we regard as reasonable. What do we regard as private? What would a reasonable person regard as private? It's not necessarily coextensive with property rights. So if you're on a public phone, you still have a reasonable expectation that the government won't be listening in. So the Supreme Court said about 50 years ago. Now Facebook has changed the way that we are together again as a society, or social media more generally. And now the law needs to make yet another adjustment.
So the law's still catching up.
Yeah, the law's always catching up. That's the thing about the law that's kind of cool and fun. It's always – you're always looking back at the precedents but trying to apply them in a forward-looking way. And that's complicated, but that's the fun of it too, I think.
Well, I wanted to ask both of you about Fourth Amendment, right to privacy, search and seizure too. So I'm glad you mentioned that, Professor Grabe. Let me also invite our listeners again to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Are we reconciling our Constitution, our nation's founding document, with the technology of our modern world, or are we still just catching up, as Professor Gravey said? Again, join us 1-800-892-6477. Also, if you want to comment specifically on the two cases that we're looking at this hour, one, again, is the Facebook/free speech case, if I could call it that. The other is a case that Professor Sargent, I did want to ask you about, that came up just a little bit earlier this year, the Riley case. And this has to do with what Professor Gravey just mentioned, you know, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, and so forth. Just give us the particulars on that, if you could, please.
All right. So Riley versus California, the Supreme Court held that any time a police officer or law enforcement officer wants to look at the contents of an arrestee's cell phone, so it has to be somebody who is under arrest, they need a warrant to do that. So they have to go get a neutral magistrate to approve, based on probable cause, their reason for wanting to look at what's on the cell phone. Now, this was a sea change in terms of how arrestees' property was treated in some respects, because there's an exception to the Fourth Amendment. There's an exception to the warrant requirement, and it's called search incident to arrest. And normally what was happening before Riley is once somebody was arrested, their cell phone, which was usually on their person or very near their person, the police officer or law enforcement officer would take it and look at it because it was incident to arrest. Now the Supreme Court in Riley has said you can't do that.
That's a huge deal, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. And it's a huge deal because the information that is on a cell phone often gives the law enforcement a lot of information about just about anything about the person, including whom they've talked to recently or where they've been recently or who their family is or who their friends are or what gang they're affiliated with, if they are affiliated with a gang, what kinds of conduct they've been engaging in. It's really just a wealth of information. And the Supreme Court, by saying you need to get a warrant to look in that at that cell phone and get that information, slows down the process for law enforcement. And the argument that law enforcement raised was a lot of this information is so critical to our investigation and to quickly acting on all of the information that we really can't have that situation where we can't access that information immediately. And the Supreme Court said no. There are actually two reasons why law enforcement should have to get a warrant. The first is that there's no threat to the law enforcement officer with the cell phone. For instance, like a gun presents a direct threat immediately, which is why police are allowed to confiscate and take weapons away. The cell phone is not a threatening instrument. What really the government concentrated on in Riley was the fact that the information on the cell phones could be removed.
So exactly. It could be wiped clean. Right.
It could be wiped. It could be it could be interfered with. It could be taken away. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's really not a concern because there are ways in which cell phone information can be preserved. For instance, disable the phone, turn it off. As soon as it's found, just disable it so that the information can't be wiped. Also, in terms of encryption, put the cell phone in places where it can't be wiped. For instance, in a Faraday bag, when we get our easy passes, for instance, and they come in those metallic bags, or we used to put our cameras in those metallic bags when we'd send them through the X-ray machine so that the film, when we used film, wouldn't get interfered with. That's a Faraday bag. And placing your cell phone in a Faraday bag keeps the waves from impeding and getting at the cell phone.
So a police officer could do that.
Absolutely. And that's a very expedient way of preserving the evidence without having to look at it immediately. It preserves the evidence.
How hard is it? I have a question for you, Professor Gravey. But Professor Sargent, how hard is it to get a warrant? We hear about this all the time. Well, just get a warrant. You're a former judge. How quick or slow is it?
In my experience, it depends on the complexity of the warrant. But warrants can be obtained relatively quickly. Usually what has to happen is the law enforcement officer has to write up an application and present probable cause in the application, talking about what's happened, what the information is that they're looking for, why they have reason to believe they're going to find it, where they're going to look for it. And they bring it to or send it to or fax it to or this in this day and age, iPad it to a judge who reviews it. And if the judge finds probable cause, which is a relatively low standard of proof, if the judge finds that probable cause, the judge can issue the search warrant. The tricky part comes in, though, when the judge or the neutral magistrate is not readily available and in the middle of the night, in geographic locations where judges are not easily accessible or reachable, there can be – it can slow the process down. So in my experience, it really does depend on the dynamic as it's happening. Who's available? What time is it? How quickly are the officers able to write out that application? They may be in the middle of the scene, in which case it's not like they can just whip out their computers and write up an application, although I think that's becoming more and more
available. From their phones or their iPads or whatever. Although I am imagining, you know, this is probably not completely true, but that more crimes probably happen at night. And so that's not when judges are working. You've got to find them.
Well, it depends on what kinds of crimes are happening. Actually, quite a few cyber crimes happen over a long period of time, crimes where the information on computers is the important information. So I wouldn't say that most crime or more crimes happen at night. Different crimes.
Gotcha. Sure. Break-ins and so forth. Right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about some of the high-tech cases that have come before the high court recently. For example, the one concerning a man who made threatening statements or a threat on Facebook towards his estranged wife. Now we're talking about another case that came up recently, whether or not law enforcement officers can use your cell phone, check out the information on it with or without a warrant. Give us a call. What constitutes a threat on social media? What do you think? Also, how much privacy do you expect on Facebook or on your phone or elsewhere? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. So, John Graby, you're our constitutional scholar. I do have to ask you this. Does the Constitution specifically spell out a right to privacy? This always comes up.
Yeah, the word privacy doesn't appear anywhere in the Constitution.
Nowhere.
But that doesn't mean that the Constitution doesn't protect privacy. There are many provisions of the Constitution that by implication suggest that privacy is, you know, as a concept, at least at a highly general level, is constitutionally protected. I mean, the Fourth Amendment. Yes, it doesn't use the word privacy, but it says that that the government cannot intrude into your home unreasonably, and at least in most circumstances, without a warrant. Well, what value is that protecting? That's protecting the value of privacy, and it's uncontroversial to say that the Constitution protects many concepts and rights by implication or by structure. The right to vote is also nowhere explicitly provided for in the Constitution. Yet the whole system presupposes that citizens will be voting, at least, you know, at the state level. So to say that just because it's not written into the Constitution, there's no right, you know, that's a little bit of a stretch. But it's true. There is no provision of the Bill of Rights that specifically protects privacy or attempts to define the scope of the privacy that is protected as a constitutional matter.
That's what makes
matter.
It so tricky, right?
Right.
I mean, you're trying to apply this broad concept of privacy, but you're using very specific language, search and seizure, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean that's the complication of constitutional interpretation. You know, how do you take this document that was written 230 years ago and keep it a good and useful constitution for a modern society? And you know, that's at the heart of the debate. There are some who say, well, you have to freeze it in time and interpret it according to what it was understood to mean at the time it became law. Otherwise, we're being ruled by judges who are imposing their values on us. That's the originalist school. And then there are those who say that's impossible. The Constitution needs to be a living, breathing document. It needs to be adaptable to new circumstances. And there's absolutely no reason why we shouldn't entrust to our judges the ability to interpret it in new contexts in a way that preserves our fundamental values.
Wow. Yeah, I'd love your thoughts, too, on that, Professor Sargent. This living, breathing, stretchable, how far can you stretch it and still be true to its principles? Mm-hmm. It's a great question.
Well, the Supreme Court, especially in California versus Riley, kind of raised an interesting sub-issue. And it goes along with what we hear people say nowadays more frequently than I've ever heard it before, which is, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what's the big deal? Let people go in and see it. If you're not hiding anything, go for it. And I think that that is a really problematic type of statement and speaks directly against the protections that the Fourth Amendment is meant to offer. Because if you think about it, what the Supreme Court has recently affirmed is that just because people have information that isn't inculpatory or isn't criminal doesn't mean that they don't have an interest in other people not knowing about it. And I use the example of internet searches when I teach. For instance, if you're doing an internet search on, say, WebMD, and you, for whatever reason, look up every sexually transmitted disease that ever has existed and does exist. If people get a hold of that information, the Supreme Court recognizes that there's a danger that people are going to make inferences about why you are looking for that information. Do you have those sexually transmitted diseases? Are you transmitting those sexually transmitted diseases? Do you know somebody who has them, et cetera, et cetera? And that's nobody's business but the person who's doing the internet search. So there's a real protective element to the Fourth Amendment that protects more than just speech that's exculpatory. It protects inculpatory speech because it has to protect all speech. It has to give a level of personal ownership to all speech because all speech is personal. It only becomes criminal or only becomes unprotected when it's speech that is of such a nature that it interferes with somebody else's liberty or their ability to function or is a criminal act. And it's very how one gets at whether speech is becoming
crossing that line.
That's a very tricky question. And that's the one that the Supreme Court is grappling with right now in
that Alonis case. Right. All right. Well, more of your calls and questions after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, we're examining high tech through the lens of the Constitution. You can join us. We're looking at two specific cases, actually, that have come up just recently. One heard this week before the Supreme Court concerning threats made on Facebook, whether this language was or was not protected by the First Amendment freedom of speech. We've also been talking about another case concerning privacy rights and whether police officers can or cannot search your smartphone with a warrant. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What kind of privacy do you think we should expect on our phones, on our Facebook sites, on other social media sites? What constitutes a threat on social media? How much privacy do we expect out of Facebook or Google or some of these other companies that have so much of our information? And more broadly, how far can we stretch our Constitution to adapt to modern society? We've been talking about that as well. Again, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And John Grabe, a question for you. This came up just a couple minutes ago, talking about the presumed right to privacy, even though you explained it's not specifically spelled out in the Constitution. The searches that Professor Sargent talked about before the break, we wouldn't want the whole universe to know if we were searching for information about sexually transmitted diseases for whatever reason. That search was probably done on Google. Mm-hmm. What about Google and Facebook and other big communications conglomerates? How do they fit into this picture of privacy rights?
Well, they're, you know, as you, they're private companies, and you're exposing you are deliberately in running a Google search, you are deliberately providing information to third parties. The law has historically said, look, if you are going to expose something that you might otherwise want to keep private, you're going to lose the privacy that's inherent in that. Again, we're struggling, though, with the fact that this type of exposure, you know, typing something into Google search, is a new type of exposure. This isn't the same thing as putting something in your garbage was 30 years ago. That's the context in which this used to come up. Should the police be able to go through your garbage without having probable cause or a warrant? And the Supreme Court said, yes, they can do that. That's not inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment, because if you want to keep something private, just don't throw it out.
Interesting.
Well,
yeah.
How far do you take that? I mean, do we say to modern society, look, if you don't want people to know what types of searches you're doing, well, then don't do those searches. Well, how practical, how reasonable is that? And what is, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all supposed to be, well, what do we as a society regard as reasonable? And given the fact that everybody is on the internet these days, and almost everybody has done a Google search at some point, you know, maybe we have some shifting ideas about that notion of exposure and losing privacy protection simply because you've given some information or exposed something to a third party. And the law is going to need to grapple with that.
So the idea, Professor Grabe, is in doing that search, you've implicitly said, you know, I guess I have to be okay with people knowing that I did this, because it's so out there.
Yeah, that's the anti-privacy argument that, look, you know, if you're going to take measures, if you're going to take advantage of the public garbage system by throwing things in there, well, don't expect that your papers aren't going to be read by somebody. It's a similar, you know, and then by analogy here is, well, if you're going to send an email that you know is going to be routed through some third party, don't expect that that third party won't read it.
I haven't heard the internet described as the public garbage system before, but I hear what you're saying. Let's take another call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. From Boston, Samantha is calling in. Hi, Samantha. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. How are you? Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I had a situation a while back where one of my photos from my school website was taken and put on a revenge porn site. And you can imagine my shock and surprise, because it was just a harmless photo. But I felt victim to someone. I don't even know what happened. So I just wanted your input. I would like to see that put to justice, but I don't know what it would look like to someone in the court.
But. So someone took your school photo, Samantha, and put it on a revenge porn site.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. And you're obviously and understandably saying you did not like that, and you would like this person to be, well, brought to justice, but how do you know who it is? You're going to have to fill us in a little bit here, Professor Sargent. What's a revenge porn site?
A revenge porn site is a site that there are several sites that develop, and people who are seeking revenge or looking to get other people exposed in a way that they did not want to be or intend to be exposed, people will put their pictures up on sites, either Photoshop their heads onto bodies that are naked in compromising positions, doing things that the person whose head the rest of the body belongs to, that doesn't belong to that body.
It sounds like that's what happened to Samantha.
Yes, exactly.
And Samantha, by the way, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Yeah, Samantha, it's a terrible thing, and I am sorry that you had to go through that. It's difficult if you've put photos of yourself or your friends on Facebook or on any kind of media site, and that includes a school website or anything. People are computer savvy. They take images from one thing and they put it on another thing. So when you are allowing your information to get out there, you have to be mindful of two things. Number one, you may be putting the information out there, but also organizations that you're affiliated with might be putting out information, such as photos of you, that they intend to use for purposes that are not nefarious, but other people can take that information and use it. And I know a lot of people right now who frankly don't expose themselves at all. They don't allow their image to be used. They don't allow schools or YouTube or anybody to post anything about them at all.
Wow, good luck with that, though. I mean, you both work at universities. They want a nice website for the university, and here are professors, and here are their headshots. And, I mean, you almost have to put yourself out there.
I mean, not everyone,
but
in order not to put yourself out there, you have to be incredibly vigilant.
It's interesting to hear, and Samantha, again, our sympathies. Is there anything in this right to privacy that we've been talking about, Professor Graby, that applies to Samantha? Or is it just, you know, someone's being really mean and it's just too bad, but there's nothing she can do about
it? There's also a tradition. I mean, we've recognized that one's privacy and one's reputation is protectable. I mean, and the laws of each state do recognize this is separate from constitutional privacy,
sure.
But they recognize
it's a legal issue, though.
Yeah. And so there are certainly potentially causes of action available to people in Samantha's unfortunate circumstances. The problem, of course, is getting relief and tracking down who did it, because it's, you know, once it's out there, it's very, very hard to figure out who did it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, your right to a recovery or your right to some sort of legal redress is often more theoretical than practical.
Well, Samantha, thank you for calling in. And again, our sympathies to you. And let's go to Leslie in Keene. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Thank you. I was thinking about the public library in years gone by when I had to do a research paper. I'd go to the catalog drawer and I'd look things up and nobody would know what I was looking up. Unless they tried to figure out which letter of the alphabet I was in. And so I'm thinking that the fact that Google and other search engines are kind of like that, that's if I wanted to research something, I would go on to those search engines. And I don't understand why that wouldn't be as private as going to the library and going to the card catalog 40 years ago.
You know, Leslie, I had a similar thought as the professors were talking about that. But what do you think, Professor Sargent? Why isn't it the same thing?
Well, it isn't the same thing because it's accessible. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that people can look at it. And people, frankly, if you had gone to the library, I suppose somebody could have stood over your shoulder and watched you do that library catalog search. It would have been awkward and uncomfortable, and you probably would have said something about it. But at the same time, it could still be observed. It's just that now it can be observed in a really accessible, readily accessible way. And that information, because it's on public sites, it's on corporate sites, it's using utilities, it's using various electronic methods that are public, the person who is utilizing those methods is not the only person who is allowed access legally to that information. So it becomes different just by virtue of the fact of how it's being transmitted.
Well, so John Graby, are we giving up privacy for the sake of convenience?
We are. And, you know, and it's not just convenience, too. You know, we want everything. You know, we want contradictory things. We want our privacy, but we also want our government to keep us safe in a world where we have been attacked in a way that raises existential concerns about the future of our society. And we also expect our government to prevent that from happening again. And these electronic records in libraries, these records of cell phone usage, email, et cetera, those are the means by which law enforcement track the sort of behavior that we are expecting them to, you know, to cut off, to nip in the bud.
Yeah, Professor Sargent.
What's going to be very interesting along these lines is the use of the body cameras that we've been talking about in the media in the wake of the Ferguson incident and Eric Garner. Police are now being – there are questions about whether or not police should wear body cameras to tape and memorialize every interaction that they have. And this is an interesting thought because a lot of people have just sort of knee-jerk reacted, yes, these cameras, they're great. They'll show us exactly what's going on. A picture is worth a thousand words, et cetera. And to some extent, I agree with that. But also, we have to realize that we compromise privacy, that these cameras will not just be taking photos or video of the interaction. They're going to catch background. They're going to catch they're more like surveillance cameras in a way if they're used perhaps improperly. But they can be used to invade people's privacy in a broader sense. And if that's the case, then we have to be careful what we ask for.
Yeah, Professor Grabe, go ahead. The body cameras. I'm glad you raised that, Professor Sargent, because that may be the next frontier in terms of some of these court cases. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in a case from a couple of years ago, the Maryland versus King case, which involved the constitutionality of taking a swab every time you arrest somebody to create a database of DNA. And the Supreme Court said that's okay. It's much like taking a fingerprint. Well, is it? Justice Scalia, in a powerful dissent in that case, said it's absolutely not okay. It's quite different from taking a fingerprint. Plus, at the time, fingerprint technology was new and available. Questions arose about, you know, is it okay to be taking fingerprints from everybody that we bring in to create this information society? Again, we want both things.
We want full information so we can
do.
Catch the bad guys.
Exactly.
But don't get my information.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's why the law is struggling with this issue right now.
Yeah, the body camera issue is really interesting. Yep. Professor Sargent, go ahead. You want to jump back in?
And I'm thinking about what our earlier caller Yolanda said. She was concerned that Mr. Alonis was hiding behind the Fourth Amendment or the First Amendment in order to take the actions that he was taking. And I think she was insinuating that it was a threat and it was directly against his wife. Well, I hear that frequently in discussions that I have with my students, that because someone can put something out there and make it public, can they then hide behind the Fourth and First Amendments to say, well, it's out there, but I put it out there in a way that I didn't intend it to have the particular consequence that you perhaps are saying I intended to have. And in fact, my speech is protected. It's interesting to think of the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment as shields versus swords, whether someone can use it to justify behavior that others would say people have already made public and is already in the public forum.
Did you want to jump in there too, Professor Grabe, on this idea of people using, I love the way you put it, Professor Sargent, a shield or a sword?
Well, that's the problem with you know, new constitutional rulings. They are then taken, you know, a constitutional ruling is handed down and it's handed down in a particular context. But then people will be sort of looking for that, looking at that as a tool for, you know, protecting them in terms of what they want to do. So, you know, another example, this is outside the technological realm. The court has been issuing constitutional rulings protecting the right to spend money on political campaigns. These rulings establish new First Amendment rights. Those First Amendment rights now dictate strategy, that organizations, look at those rulings and set themselves up so as to take advantage of constitutional privacy and protection and are able to sometimes avoid disclosure. So.
You know, just getting back to the body cameras very quickly, because this is big. President Obama is saying we want to help local police departments fund this. There's a bill coming in the New Hampshire legislature to possibly give state police, not local police, but state police body cameras. I just wonder what you think, Professor Sargent, about some of the privacy issues that might come up. Again, let's say a police officer enters a domestic dispute. Do you really want that video possibly available for everybody?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And I have to look at it from so many of my own personal experiences as a public defender. I have to say that I would have liked a lot of the interactions that the police testified about in court to have been videotaped because my clients' accounts of what happened were so different. And I thought, oh, if we could just have that video, we'd
sure.
be able to see. But then again, I don't think that body cameras solve the issue because, and I think that the what happened yesterday, the grand jury decision not to indict the police officer in the Gardner case proves there was video in that case. Everybody watched the video in that case, and still the decision that the grand jury made was based on not only the video, but also the supplementing testimony that they heard. So even though a video is there, it doesn't tell the whole story.
Do you want to jump in very quickly? Privacy rights, body cameras, Professor Grabe.
Oh, I think Jen sums it up well. You know, there is no silver bullet. You know, even if we move to this new technology, there are going to be vexing questions. There are going to be questions about the reliability of video.
Whether it's edited.
Whether it's edited, whether it captures context accurately. We never get to a point where we solve these problems.
Well, full employment for lawyers and law professors. We'll put it that way. Professor Sargent, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Professor Jennifer Sargent. She's a visiting associate professor at Dartmouth. She served as a judge here in New Hampshire for 8 years and as a public defender. Professor Grabe, it's good to see you, too. Thank you very
much. Thank you for inviting me.
That's John Grabe, constitutional scholar, professor at UNH School of Law. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producers, Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Nate Grabe, and I'm Laura Kanoy.